Mr. O'Donnell.
Good afternoon, Justice Holland. May it please the court, my name is Bernard O'Donnell. I am here on behalf of Vincenzo De Dominicis, who was convicted in Sussex County of driving under the influence and sentenced to imprisonment. It'd be tempting to start this argument, or it'd be tempting to confine this argument to only one thing. I could stand here and read the opening to this argument made by the prosecutor in this case. It's an illustration of our doctrine of res ipsa. It speaks for itself. Nonetheless, I know that the court has read the opening argument and is familiar with it, so I won't waste the court's time by reading it. Now, the state acknowledges in this instance that the argument was improper because in this expansive Spider-Man speech, the prosecutor was, in essence, asking the jury to enlist themselves in the war against drunken driving, and that's highly improper. What under these circumstances, and the state does not disagree with that. The state, however, claims that two things, that it was a matter of strategy or tactics, and secondly, that it was harmless. The error was harmless because the case was not close. Now, insofar as strategy, we submit that the record is very weak insofar as this being a conscious trial strategy. Because in this case, as in many cases,
not to object.
Yes. The trial attorney may not have had a clear recollection of what had occurred at trial. He may not have been paying attention at that particular time at the beginning of the argument. He may have been distracted. But in his affidavit, he states that it wasn't really egregious, and because of that, there's an etiquette that he follows that you shouldn't object. Well, that justification offered on his own behalf is weak because immediately after the Spider-Man speech, the defense attorney did jump to his feet and object vehemently about something that wasn't objectionable. And that was when the prosecutor started discussing the evidence in the case. That's what an opening argument is supposed to be about. And that is when he objected. And also, he made a discovery violation claim at that point. So this record probably is more likely to support the observation that this was either an oversight or, secondly, that trial counsel didn't realize that the state's argument was improper. Now, insofar as whether this was harmful or not, the test is that the court, of course, looks at the closeness of the case, the centrality of the issue affected by the error, and in this error the state does not dispute, and the steps taken to mitigate the error. Well, we know that there were no steps taken to mitigate the error. The state claims that the case was not close, and the issue was not central. Well, we dispute that, and although there was substantial evidence of intoxication, there's no question that several people testified that Mr. De Dominicis was intoxicated that night. But the issue that was really in contention at this trial, the central issue, was whether he was driving or not. And we submit that there was enough there for the jury to find that it was less likely that he was driving or in operating a vehicle than it was that he was intoxicated.
What was he charged with? Was he charged with driving or having under his physical control?
He was charged with by information with did drive a motor vehicle upon the Atlantic Liquors parking lot. So he was charged with driving, not operation of a vehicle. That's in the information at A7.
Now,
Wasn't there testimony in the record from the, someone in the store and the police officer that they both viewed this unavailable videotape and identified him as driving into the lot?
Yes, there was. But the best evidence for operation of, or for driving the vehicle would have been the videotape. The best evidence was missing here.
I looked at the record, and help me if I missed it. Was there an objection to that videotape missing at the trial level? It's not an issue on appeal.
No.
But as I understood it, the testimony of the store owner and the police officer that they viewed the videotape and the defendant was the driver came in without objection.
Correct.
Okay.
So there was no objection on that basis. But nonetheless, the jury or a juror could have conceivably thought, we submit under these circumstances, that it's a videotape. It's a store surveillance videotape. Jurors and everyone else have seen store surveillance videotapes. Some are very clear. Many others are grainy and obscure insofar as what they portray. You have here a situation where it was nighttime also, around 9:30 at night. It wasn't daylight. We don't know about his illumination. And we have a bias here, says of witnesses, and that people can say that they take a look at something, and it's perfectly possible, we submit under these circumstances, that a police officer or a trooper and a store manager could take a quick look at videotape. Yeah, he's driving.
And doesn't the record also reflect that when the officer approached the defendant at the vehicle, the defendant was in the vehicle, seated in the driver's side of the car?
That's what the record indicates, yes. That was the testimony. Now, the issue, so the centrality, says, of the issue is the element of driving, says the vehicle, not so much the intoxication. And we submit that under these circumstances, a juror where the evidence, and we submit it's critical evidence, the state contends it's critical evidence that the witnesses observed him driving, but that tape that was not available to the jurors to look at. It's conceivable that a jury could have looked at that videotape, was on this record, and said, hey, that's kind of grainy or dark, says we don't know who's driving, says that vehicle. I mean, yes, we think there's one person in there, but we don't know. We're speculating that that is overwhelming as evidence, because it may not be. The state argues that the...
Well, let me stop you there, because I'm a little bit confused. If the only evidence that was presented to the jury with respect to whether your client was driving or not was two witnesses who said, we looked at the videotape and we both saw that he was driving. There was no other evidence. There was no evidence that, oh, well, somebody else had been using the car earlier that night and that person was around, and you know, all kinds of other possibilities that are frequently thrown out there for the jury to say, well, I'm not sure. But none of that happened here, right?
No, it didn't happen, but under those circumstances, we submit that it's conceivable at trial, says that even if there are two witnesses who testify at trial that a defendant was driving, it's not inconceivable that a jury could find their testimony not persuasive enough. It's a matter of credibility.
I understand, but you're trying to make the argument that this was a close case with respect to, at least with respect to whether he was driving or not, and yet the only record we have is that two people said he was driving based upon viewing a videotape. There was no objection to the fact that there was no videotape. There was nothing that impeached the credibility of either of those witnesses in terms of, you know, were you wearing your glasses? Were you drunk? You know, was there some reason why maybe you wouldn't make an accurate identification? So you're asking us to reach a conclusion that it was a close case because who knows, the jury might not have believed the only two witnesses on this point who had no reason to have been telling anything but the truth?
Yes, I'm asking the court to accept that because the jury can find that that testimony is not persuasive enough. A juror could say, hey, I would have liked to have seen that videotape. Why should I have to rely upon what is essentially hearsay testimony?
Let me ask you a different question. The state acknowledges that the statements by the prosecutor were improper and attributed to the fact that the prosecutor might have been inexperienced and represents that they've been told not to do that again. The state makes that concession because our court has said that in prior cases these types of arguments are improper. Are you making any argument that we should apply Hunter to this case?
Yes, because it was so flagrant, and secondly, prosecutors are often aware of these things, or should be. And frankly, I don't know whether the court has noticed it, but since around 2000, 2001, when Hunter and a few other decisions, I've noticed, candidly, some remarkable, improvement in prosecutorial arguments in the past 10 years, insofar as not doing the things that they were being done before. Some pretty deep, there has been improvement. So the prosecutors, I think, are listening and teaching themselves how to do things better insofar as making arguments to the jury that don't impede on a defendant's constitutional right to a fair trial. But under those circumstances, it's not like if that is happening, that's commendable, but it doesn't mean when something flagrant does happen, you get a free pass and go and sin no more.
Just one factual question, Mr. O'Donnell. It was part of the defense's case, was it not, that the defendant here was driven to the scene by his girlfriend, and then his girlfriend went to some other location, fast food place. Did that come from the defendant's testimony?
That was his statement to the police officer that came into evidence.
And that's how it was before the jury, and it was argued.
Yes.
There were no girlfriend was ever produced to testify.
She didn't testify at trial.
So that's another circumstance that the jury could have taken into account in weighing what the facts were or what the evidence should show.
I can't say that they could not take that into account, no.
I just double-checked. You didn't cite Hunter in your opening brief, mm-hmm. and you didn't make a Hunter argument. Our normal rule of appellate practice and procedure is that if an argument's not fully and fairly presented in an opening brief, then it's waived on appeal. So your whole argument seems to go to whether this is harmless error or not. Hunter obviously would be distinguishable because in Hunter we say if it's repetitive, independent of whether it would constitute reversible error in and of itself, we apply the criteria identified in Hunter to make sure that this type of thing doesn't happen again. So tell us how, if you're making a Hunter argument, we can reach the Hunter argument if you never presented it in your brief.
We didn't present it. I'm not asking the court to decide, says on Hunter, because as I pointed out, this type of argument is not so repetitive anymore, but due to its flagrancy, and it is not harmless error, says in this case. And notwithstanding that it's not repetitive, it can still be unfairly prejudicial. So there's not a policy argument here at all. I concede that. Insofar, the state also argues that it didn't affect the centrality of the issue at trial because there was no injury here, no car crash, no this. Well, that really that we submit is neither here nor there insofar as the nature.
That's what I'm trying to, piece together is it struck me that the reason why the prosecutor ventured into territory that the state concedes is inappropriate was that the state actually, in their brief, suggests that the jury was instructed that driving included driving, operating, or having control of the vehicle. That there would be a potential that the defense would minimize the evidence that the defendant got behind the wheel after leaving the liquor store and was trying to depart, and try to emphasize that, you know, the only way you actually get havoc on the road is for someone to start up the vehicle and then put it on the road. I mean, that seemed to me the most rational reason for why he was getting into this. What I'm trying to figure out is, it may be verboten for territory the state concedes of this, how in any way would have influenced the jury to convict your client if they did not believe that your client had control of a vehicle while he was intoxicated?
Well, it would have, you know, lowered the bar for persuasion that he was a danger to, because the image, you don't need, not merely people who drive while intoxicated are not simply charged only when they cause car crashes. So, and much of the aggressive posture insofar as prosecuting driving under the influence is that these people who drive, even if they do not cause car crashes, they are perils that's on the roadway. And so whether or not there was a car crash, the central issue here is whether he was driving and intoxicated.
Well, and what I'm getting at is I understand that as the state concedes the prosecutor did something wrong. Okay. I didn't understand the argument to be drunk driving is so horrible that if you drink within a 10-yard radius of a car, you ought to go to prison because it's so horrible. If you lean over and grab the wheel, it's so horrible. The focus of it is this horrible thing, but then when he gets down to it, he's talking about, you know, why not just the people driving down the road, right? He's mm-hmm. focused on it because the goal is to stop people who are under the influence before they drive away. Mm-hmm. Part of what he's addressing there is that one of the theories of the state is there's two bases on which the jury could find him guilty, was that he drove onto the lot, that he was actually driving on the road and drove on the lot. The other was that he was planning to drive away and he got caught mm-hmm. Right before he did that. Now, assuming that it's wrong, we now get to the, you know, the harmless here. The evidence, you know, take me through. I'm trying to draw the connection between the wrong and how and there was an unfair conviction of your client given the mountain of evidence against him.
Well, the prosecutor described the dangers on the highway presented by drunken drivers. And the jury was there to decide whether this, the jury.
But isn't the prejudice, not to interrupt you, but I'm trying to, does there have to be something wrong about what the prosecution suggests that would lead a jury into the area of passion to just lash out and convict somebody because they were sort of associated with a crime? And what I mean very particularly here is, what would have led this jury, because of what the prosecutor said, to be inclined to convict your client if they believed that he never actually drove the vehicle or was controlling the vehicle with intention to drive it away?
Well, if we don't convict him, he may do it again.
He may do what again?
Drive.
No.
Where?
That's what I'm saying is, what would they, that he might go somewhere with his girlfriend, and this time, because he got away with it, not be in the passenger side?
We've got to send him a message that we will be making the roads safer if we convict him.
So they would convict him, so they would be inclined to convict him even if they believed he did not in fact control the vehicle?
If they harbored a doubt, they'd be more likely to convict him if they thought he presented a danger to themselves and others on the roadway. I'm sorry I can't give a better answer, but that's the way we saw it.
You're into the time you've reserved.
Okay. If the court has no other questions, I'd like to reserve that time. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Wallace.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court.
Before you start, can you just clarify for me when the defendant committed the crime? Was he charged with driving under the influence because he entered the parking lot of the liquor store from the highway, or because as he sat in the car when the officer approached him, he had the car in his actual physical control?
Both, Your Honor. Both were a theory put forth by the state as to his liability for this. Under 4177C3, drive is defined as driving, operating, or having actual physical control, and the state need not allege that specific act in the indictment or in the charging document, and they argue the various theories here, and that's why this case really isn't close, because if the jury wanted to find him guilty based on the driving in that the trooper said that he saw on the videotape and that the worker said he saw on the videotape, they could have. But if they said, all right, look, I'm not as sure because I haven't seen the tape myself. When the police officer says he's sitting there behind the driver's wheel, keys in the ignition, everything else, and then slides over to the passenger seat when I happen to come close by, that's actual physical control. And the jury was instructed on that. We put the instructions in our appendix at B910. And therefore, that's why we say this is not a close case as to the evidence. Look,
how did the testimony about viewing the videotape get into evidence?
Your Honor, I mean, it was a physical act that the jury, that both persons said they saw on the tape. How did it come in without the tape? Gets you into very interesting hearsay questions, because the tape isn't necessarily hearsay. It is a piece of missing evidence that they said they saw.
During the direct examination of the witnesses who saw the tape?
Yes. I'm sorry. If that was I didn't know whether the court was asking how legally did this happen or how physically did this happen. Physically, it happened through the testimony.
Are we in slow motion rule 61 here, Mr. Wallace?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because I don't know that necessarily that a witness, and I'm going to be honest with the court, I haven't untangled all the evidentiary issues that might be in watching a videotape and being able to testify about what one saw when the tape is no longer in existence, although there have been other cases, certainly, where that occurs. Now that person might get a DeBerry instruction or something of the like, because it may be missing, but doesn't prohibit the person who saw that from putting it on. Videotapes are not hearsay. They're not statements.
Well, what was the defense? We've got a defense attorney who didn't object to the prosecutor's argument, although everyone acknowledges it was objectionable. And we've got this evidentiary issue that you and Justice Ridgely are discussing that was debatable, that was never raised. So what was the defense as you understand it?
As I understand it, the defense was he wasn't driving and you shouldn't hold him liable for driving, that he didn't do enough. He wasn't going to exercise actual physical control over this car. Either the trooper was wrong or he was getting somebody else to drive him. He got driven up by somebody else. They're wrong when they say they saw him on a videotape that, by the way, isn't here. He was driven up by somebody else, abandoned there, did the right thing by trying to go over to the Pizza Hut and get somebody else to drive him or whatever. That was the defense in this case. Don't hold my guy liable for what they're saying he did, because sure, he was drunk, but he didn't do any of the acts that would have held him liable for driving, however you define that, whether it's actual moving the car or whether it's being in actual physical control. That was the defense as I understood it to be. I want to look, obviously, it's never a comfortable feeling to be here on on the side of the state when, admittedly, the prosecutor, in the manner and degree in which he made this argument, was improper. We do not question that. We understand Hooks. We understand Hooks says you can talk to some extent about the societal circumstances of certain offenses, but you certainly can't go, if the error was here, it certainly, and the error is here, the manner and degree in which the prosecutor did it in this case. So I'm not here to justify what he said. But I think that when we apply the plain standard, the plain error standard to it, this case is much like Black, which this court dealt with 20 years ago.
You know, your comment that it's not even a close case really rests on, you know, the testimony of the two witnesses who saw the videotape, which in turn showed the defendant driving the car into the parking lot.
Well, and the testimony of the trooper who saw him actually behind the wheel as he was getting ready to leave, because that's actual physical control. That's a separate act, and that's separate driving under the law, because C3 tells us that 4177.
Okay, so what happened was the trooper saw the defendant behind the wheel, and
as the trooper came up.
Slides over to the passenger
side. Yes. When the trooper gets called, the trooper gets into the parking lot, he actually sees DeDominicus behind the wheel. DeDominicus then slides over to the passenger side.
Let's focus just for the moment on the videotape. Did the existence of the videotape come out for the first time in the case during the trial? The reason I ask that is that I believe there's an argument in your brief that the videotape, although it's no longer available, could have been sought in discovery and it wasn't. And that argument presupposes that there was, you know, reason to know about it.
Your Honor, I honestly do not know. I don't know how that was litigated pretrial. And because there's been no claim about DeBerry or anything else about that testimony.
Well, am I wrong? Did I mischaracterize your brief?
I'd have to relook, but I don't believe that we spoke much about that it could have been sought beforehand. But I may be confusing myself.
How does the DUI statute apply to activities in a commercial parking lot?
Well, under 21, there is a provision, and the number escapes me right now, of Title 21, that specifically says that DUI offenses occur everywhere. Commercial parking lots, roadways, everything. It's in the 20s. 2101 maybe even, and I can almost see it in my head, but basically says this subchapter applies, the subchapter that DUI, reckless driving, alcohol-related in there, applies outside the roadways also.
All right, so we'll find the number.
I think it's 2101.
We'll find the number, but assuming we do, then what you're saying hypothetically is if you're in a restaurant in a shopping center parked in a commercial parking lot, and you consume alcohol above the legal limit, and you come out and you sit behind the driver's in the driver's seat with the keys, you haven't turned on the motor, you haven't done anything. If there are other facts that I'm not putting in the hypothetical, a police officer could arrest you for sitting there in the commercial parking lot for driving under the influence because you have a motor vehicle in your actual physical control.
Yes, Your Honor. That is the state of the law, and it's been the state of the law for quite a while. In fact, there's specific cases that say you don't have to show an intent to drive and those types of things. It's to keep that intoxicated person away from behind the wheel of a car because of the unpredictability of what that intoxicated person may do.
I remember those cases, but all the ones that come to my mind involve people who were on the shoulder of the road. I'm trying to recollect a commercial parking lot case, and none comes to mind immediately.
Not that it's a Delaware Supreme Court opinion, or maybe even Superior Court. I know that just in the past year, we've argued one before the Superior Court that was on appeal from the Court of Common Pleas, where it was a Shell parking lot guy with almost a very similar situation. The proprietor called saying, "Look, you've got a guy passed out in my parking lot." and, you know, the car's running at that point.
But I understand here there was also evidence, and I just want to make sure that the person running the liquor store, when he refused to sell liquor to the defendant went to get in his vehicle and leave. He didn't go to Pizza Hut until the manager of the liquor store confronted him, at which point he exited the driver's side when he was told that the police were going to be called. And right. The police were called by this guy, and when the police came, he was in the driver's, according to the officer, back in the driver's side of the car.
Your Honor is absolutely correct. I forgot about that second entry into the car, and actually he confronted him. He goes out to Pizza Hut, goes over, and actually brings a worker from Pizza Hut over, and the proprietor of the liquor store even said, look, you really don't want to get involved in this. I've already called the police, to the Pizza Hut worker. Pizza Hut worker leaves. And from that choreography comes Mr. DeDominicus's story that my girlfriend left and I went over to see if she was there, et cetera, et cetera.
So there were basically three situations in which the jury could have found that he was driving within the meaning of statute. They could have concluded, based on the testimony about the videotape and the circumstances, that in fact, because they never met the girlfriend, right?
Right.
They could have concluded he drove there because his car's there. He's the one who's got the keys of it, because she would have had to give him the keys. I mean, there's a whole lot of things that would have happened for him to. But then he leaves the store after not being sold, and the manager sees him get into the driver's side of the car. He's about to basically leave, and the guy says, if you don't want to do this, I'm going to call the cops. He gets out, goes to Pizza Hut, and then the third thing is with the police officer.
Yes, he's back in the car by the time the police officer gets there. So, yes, I apologize. I missed the middle one. Thank you.
Mr. Wallace, your harmless error argument, well, first of all, does the state have the burden of proving harmless error?
Well, Your Honor, it's interesting. We never specifically said harmless error. We said this isn't plain error, because what we're using is three prongs that and
let me ask you this. Does the weight of the evidence in this case basically give a carte blanche for the prosecutor to have said anything
No.
in the opening statement? Well, where's the tipping point on that?
I think what has to happen, Your Honor, is you have to look at the three considerations that the court looks at in the plain error analysis, and we agree. Because there was no objection made, there was nothing done to mitigate that he went overboard in speaking about the overall societal impacts of DUI. So I think where it rests is in that second set, in the second consideration, and that is the centrality of the issue. And I think that's where Black is instructive in this particular case. If his argument had been, look, he's a drunk and you shouldn't believe a drunk. Drunks are going to lie. They're going to tell you this. That goes to the key issue in this case, which was credibility. Do you believe his story or not? As opposed to a more open argument, albeit improper, about the overall societal interest in trying to keep drunks away from cars. And look, it was not well delivered. I believe that the Chancellor has it exactly right. You can see where he's getting to, and that is, look, our laws are the way they are to keep people, keep drunks and cars separated. And you're going to see that this is an actual physical control case to a certain extent, because he talks about that at the very end. So, no, he does not have carte blanche. I think in this circumstance, because of the subject of the impropriety was not central to the issue in the case, which was credibility. Certainly, this court's talked many times about prosecutorial misconduct in mischaracterizing evidence or in vouching or something like that, which goes more towards when you have a case like this. Credibility is the key issue, and the misconduct goes directly to that key issue. That's why I suggest respectfully that this is much more like Black, where you have this, we're talking about the overall societal interest in keeping down crime, et cetera, but that doesn't go to the key issue in the case, which was, if I remember correctly, in Black, was also a credibility of the identification of the person. That's why I suggest respectfully it doesn't meet the plain error standard here. Not excusable. I am not here to excuse the manner and degree in which the prosecutor argued about societal interest in DUI offenses. And I would never say that any prosecutor, when you got a great case, you got carte blanche to do whatever you want because you can always fall behind harmless error. This court made it very clear in the Hunter-Baker line of cases that's not acceptable. But prosecutors are still human, and mistakes are going to happen. And I think you had a less experienced prosecutor who probably didn't think out the completeness of his argument and the possibility for it being wanting to get to the right place in the end, but getting there and taking the wrong path. I can tell the court this, and I think Mr. O'Donnell is absolutely correct. We take very seriously claims of prosecutorial misconduct. We have addressed that in our office. The last time we had a capital case litigation seminar last year, when the entirety of the office was there, it was 2 hours of discussion about all of these cases. Can I tell you that every single argument is going to be perfect? Can I tell you that prosecutors aren't going to be human? Absolutely not. But I think that's exactly what happened in this case. I had the prosecutor reread his argument. I can tell you that he apologized, first to me, because he knew I would probably be here having to argue about that. And I can assure you that he would apologize to the court if he were making this argument himself. The manner and degree in which he made it was improper, but it does not amount to plain error in this particular case. If there are no other questions, thank you.
Insofar as harmless error, one of the things in the record is that the state did make attempts to get this videotape. The state's contention now that this case, our evidence was overwhelming, and this missing videotape would have meant nothing, says to a jury. They moved heaven and earth to get that videotape. It wasn't videotape, it was a digital tape. The trooper told the sort of engineer, save this. Trooper went back, I think more than once. They actually took the surveillance system, this is the hard drive, to the state police crime lab to try to get this the evidence. Now, if this evidence was so important that a jury, it wouldn't have changed the jury's mind, why put such effort into trying to just obtain it? The second thing I'd like to just point out in rebuttal is that the defendant was charged with driving.
Is what you just told us in the record?
Yes, sir. It's at A73 of the system was taken to the state police crime lab for analysis.
One reason the state would have moved heaven and earth to do it is simply to assure the integrity of the record and to frankly do what they could to preserve what they knew to be relevant evidence that could and potentially for your client's benefit?
Yes, potentially exculpatory evidence, possibly.
Right, which doesn't mean that they necessarily viewed it as critical, but they were doing their duty, right?
Well, normally
I'm just saying that you made the argument that there was only one possible motivation for them, which is that they were desperate to get the tape and they thought there was no other way to convict your client. There's a few other possibilities, which include just trying to do their job, and even frankly knowing that if they did fail to do their job, the defendant could make arguments based on that, right?
Yes.
Well, doesn't that bring us back to Justice Ridgely's question about whether this isn't a slow-moving Rule 61 proceeding? Because when you describe the importance of the evidence, the length to which the state went to try to get the evidence, the corollary to that question is, why wasn't there an objection? And then, to follow up on the Chancellor's question, if you have a duty to gather and preserve the best evidence of driving, which would have been this tape, we would have expected to see something in the record to the effect that the evidence wasn't gathered or preserved, the defendant's entitled to a Lolly instruction, that if it had been gathered and preserved, it would have been favorable to the defendant. We don't see any of that.
No, the record does indicate, though, that there was an attempt to secure, says the evidence, but it wasn't objected to at trial, or there was no request for a Lolly instruction. Second thing I'd like to point out is that the defendant was charged with driving, not being, as Chancellor Stein pointed out, perhaps the jury could have been concerned about, they could have harbored a, try to rephrase the Chancellor's point. My point is that the jury could have harbored a doubt that the defendant was driving. They could have thought that the evidence is weak, the tape is missing, but nonetheless also thought that, you know what, he was thinking of getting in that truck and driving away, and that guy was a catastrophe waiting to happen. And under those, if jurors could have thought that, this this argument affected the centrality of the case.
In other words, the jury could have been thinking, all right, well, even if they didn't technically prove that he was driving this time, he's high risk that he's going to do it next time, so let's tag him now.
Yes, sir.
But on what? How do you draw that from what you attack is what the prosecutor said? Because what the prosecutor said that was most relevant to that was, don't minimize that someone isn't out on the highway yet producing roadkill. The state, the definition of driving includes controlling a vehicle because you got to get it to the highway. What the jury's verdict was they were charged that they could convict him for actually driving or things including within driving. The testimony was that twice he got behind the wheel of the vehicle after he got to the liquor store, right?
There was evidence to support that.
Where in the prosecutor's improper statement was he suggesting that people who don't actually get behind the wheel and control a vehicle should be convicted?
Because they can still present a danger. The jury may have believed that he was going to get in that vehicle and drive. The jury had the information to look at. He was charged with driving. A juror could have thought that, you know, they don't have that videotape. I don't think he's driving, but I think he was about to.
So wait a minute. Then you're taking argument with the jury instructions, which are very specific and are in the record?
No.
And do not say that control or operate means standing outside of a vehicle with a mens rea that you're about to get in and control and operate. Is that the instruction?
Well, there was testimony that there was keys in the truck and that he was also in the front of the truck and at one point behind. So
that's in that, right? And if that's accepted, right, that's a fact finding that would satisfy the statute. That's different than, and I'm sorry, I apologize to my colleagues for continuing, but you just said the jury could have convicted him based on the statement that if he were out of the, they could have concluded he had a state of mind. He never actually got behind the wheel, controlled the vehicle, was going to drive away. But they could look at him and say, you know, that's the kind of guy who would do that.
And possibly kill someone. And ladies and gentlemen, after this is over, you know, after this is over, if you convict this man, you can consider yourself an action hero, like Spider-Man.
Mr. O'Donnell, I'd like to ask you about your client's testimony. Did he testify or admit during his testimony that at any point he was behind the wheel with the keys in the ignition?
No, I don't believe so.
Did he admit that he was inside the truck?
Yes, I think so, yes.
But never behind the wheel?
No.
Right.
That's my recollection.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks for your argument. The court will take this matter under advisement. We'll also adjourn.
Please rise.